Okay. I guess I'll have more questions about that, but I want to go back to the, you know, you said that this was around 1915, that and then came the World Wars. Did that, you know, was agriculture then a part of the, I mean, were most people working in agriculture?
Sarah, before you do that, let me say one more consequence of what happened when EBID was created and allowed thirsty crops to be grown here.
Okay.
And that's that cotton was now a viable crop here. And so who came here to grow cotton were those people from the South who had grown cotton in the South. So there were immigrants who came to the Mesilla Valley from southern states, and they brought their own culture with them. So it wasn't until southern cotton farmers came to the Mesilla Valley in the 1920s that our schools were segregated.
Okay.
And so when you're looking at land and culture and water, once water became plentiful for cotton farmers came here from the South and then started saying we have to segregate our schools. And it wasn't segregated to white and Hispanic and black. It was the white and Hispanic children went together, but blacks had to go to a different school.
And was there a large black population?
It wasn't a large black population, but there were enough African American families in Las Cruces and in the Mesilla Valley to have a school of their own.
Okay. And that, you know, that I hadn't read about that or seen anything about that. And I'm from Oklahoma, and I know that, like, the Dust Bowl, a lot of that came about because of the cotton. They just grew the cotton so much that it eroded, or it dried out the land, and then with drought. And were there ever any issues, land issues like that here? Where the cotton, or just any of the crops, and severe drought, where crops were lost, and
I'm sure that crops had been lost in the past, but partly because we're in an artificial water environment where we pump or we get water impounded from Elephant Butte, that somewhat tempers that effect of the drought. I mean, we have drought here. Hopefully we're at a tail end of about a decade-long drought, but still, water use has continued, and pecan trees haven't failed. I mean, they haven't died because of it. There's sometimes where farmers can't get their EBID water because there's no water. Especially a couple years ago, there was not enough water to fulfill the obligations, so they cut back, and that meant that fields didn't go planted. But for those crops like the pecan trees that take so many years to mature, farmers found ways to buy groundwater from the aquifer to keep those trees alive.
Okay, and back to the culture. I mean, do you still see that today here? I mean, some of the effects, can you still see? I mean, not the segregation, but I mean, growing up in Oklahoma, I know that there are, I mean, you can still see effects of segregation, or you still see the neighborhoods, you still see parts of Oklahoma culture being affected by the segregation. And I mean, do you see that? Are there
not so much anymore. There is the school that was the African American school, Washington School, is now integrated. There is a community south of here, Vado, that has more African Americans than the average for the valley. And those African Americans came to Vado about the same time as the EBID water became available. And they came from an African American utopian experiment near Roswell that failed, called Blackdom. So some African Americans had gone to Blackdom to create this utopia that had failed, and then some of those people then moved on to Vado in the valley here.
Okay, that's a whole other
thing. Yeah, it is.
So maybe if we went back to the wars, mm-hmm. Would that be the next mm-hmm. progression?
I think that the Depression did have its effect here. We were a little bit outside of the Dust Bowl, although we had a lot of people coming down Highway 70, just like they went down Route 66, to get away from the Dust Bowl to go to Arizona and California, so they passed through here. But the Depression, you know, it was hard here, but there was enough water to... It wasn't the ecological disaster of the Dust Bowl, of that part. So World War II put strains on the agricultural community here, partly because so many men went off to fight. Mm-hmm. And it took away the farmers who had been working the fields. And then when those men came back, some did go back into farming, but some didn't. And sometimes they went back to orchards that hadn't been tended over the 4 years of war, and they had died. And this isn't just down here. I know up in Placidus, a friend of mine took me through a level field that had been an orchard before the war, that his uncles had worked, and when they came back from fighting, the orchard had died because nobody was there to water it. And so some of the agriculture around the state died just because of that. And then also there was a shift. I talked with this one gentleman in Hillsboro, who, when he was about 5 or 6, went on the last goat drive. I guess you can't call it a cattle drive, but a goat drive from Hillsboro down to the trailhead at Nutt. And that's about 40 or 50 miles. So they drove the goats from Hillsboro down there and put them on freight cars there. But that was the last one, and that was right after the war. And so then livestock production shifted from goat and sheep, at least in some of these communities, to cattle. And now it's predominantly cattle.
Okay. And so that's kind of the goats and the sheep were traditional.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other, just as far as land, were there repercussions? Did larger industries come in and buy out some of the farms that had stopped, that the men had stopped growing? And was that
I'm pretty sure that happened. I'm not positive that happened, but you also have to think of the families who had been there before the war, and then the men had gone off, and some women too, but mainly the men had gone off to war, and when they came back they looked around and said, you know what, I don't want to farm anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to Albuquerque or Phoenix or L.A. I think the way to get the good life is not to farm in a hard scrabble land like southern New Mexico. It's to go and get a factory job and earn good money. So partly it's the larger agribusinesses coming in, but I think most of the time the people who had lived on and farmed on that land were willing sellers.
Okay. And I don't think I asked you this, but nationally, because it's not only something that happened in New Mexico, it happened all over the country after World War II when people mm-hmm. came back. So do you know about numbers as far as how food production shifted from, in the country and even when we might have begun to get more food from other countries? And that's something that I know I have to research more, but I don't know if that...
No, I don't know that. I just know growing up in the 50s, we had a lot of processed food. Mm-hmm. We had TV dinners that we'd, sit in front of the TV and eat, and, we'd have soup out of cans. And I'm not sure when that shift happened, but I suspect that it happened... it didn't happen during the Great Depression, although there's been canned food since the middle part of the 19th century, especially for people on trails. They depended on canned food, but it didn't become a shift from home cooked meals to opening up a can or heating up a TV dinner. I suspect that happened in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing I do want to address, though. I mean, a traditional crop that's been around here is, of course, chili. New Mexico State University has led a role in developing new strains of chili, and have created different types of chili, not so hot, have blended jalapeno or habanero with other types to get the chili that is not so fiery. And so that development, which started here in the Mesilla Valley, has now swept through the country so that chili is, and salsa and things like that, sell more than ketchup and other condiments. And also it spread internationally. A few years ago, I was in Sweden. I was at this small town of a couple thousand. I was in the grocery store. I went around an aisle, and here was this whole section of old El Paso chili. There were canned green chili. There were taco shells. There were recipes of how to make strawberry chimichangas. I think that's a little blending of Swedish and Mexican foods. but then I was camping a little bit later, and a Swedish family right next to me, they were sitting down eating tacos. So the Southwest cuisine and the Mexican cuisine has spread way beyond the confines of the region.
And when did the university, when were they involved in working with the different chilies? Has that been?
That was from the 1920s.
Okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, a professor, a Japanese-American professor by the name of Nakayama, is one of those who interbred the different types of chili to get chili that wasn't so hot as a jalapeno, and to elongate it too and make it kind of a larger, plumper fruit.
Okay.